Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. My nature-loving friends, trapped in large cities by circumstance, often dream about escaping to natural wildlife habitats, like the Galapagos Islands, the land of Darwin's finches. These city dwellers know that cities host their own wildlife populations, but perceiving these crowding, noisy metropolises as hotbeds of wildlife evolution on a par with the Galapagos Islands seems ludicrous to them. Nonetheless, when people destroy wild habitats to build ever larger cities, the wildlife doesn't automatically disappear. My first inkling of how nature would respond to such dramatic habitat destruction came from an experiment I read about years ago. E. coli was placed in a medium the bacteria couldn't use. As expected, almost all of the bacteria died, but not all of them. The few survivors unexpectedly began multiplying at a rate much higher than that predicted by Darwin's theory of evolution. Even more surprising, soon the bacteria not only could survive in the once deadly environment, they thrived in it. Fast forward to the increasing wildlife populations in cities worldwide. Initially, any wild animal populations in the path of dedicated human urban habitat destruction did decline, and sometimes precipitously so. And sadly, some more vulnerable individuals and species did disappear completely. But not all of them always died, nor did all of them always flee. Which brings us to the fundamental difference between these city wildlife populations and their country cousins, their rate of adaptation in their new environments. The accelerated rate at which new behaviors and the physiology to support them evolve in an urban environment has gained the attention of an increasing number of biologists. Although still relatively few, these specialists comprise a dedicated group that has discovered some amazing wildlife adaptations to life in the city. Imagine animals evolving much faster than Darwin ever imagined as he observed the variations among Galapagos Island finches. In Darwin's view, only natural barriers that physically separated populations triggered evolution. I doubt he ever considered that human-made environmental changes could accomplish similarly dramatic effects, and much faster too. The process is now so well documented, it has its own name: human-induced rapid evolutionary change, or HIRAC. Instead of the mountain ranges, oceans, jungles, or other natural barriers driving evolution in Darwin's view, much smaller but more abundant environmental obstructions challenge wildlife survival in the cities. The studies of a particular species evolution in the London Underground offers a fascinating, if somewhat disconcerting, glimpse into the power of HIRAC. Imagine you're a Culex pipiens mosquito who gets swept up with the crowd or somehow blown into the London Underground. Normally, you'd feed only on birds, form large mating swarms to reproduce, and hibernate in the cold weather. But none of those options exist down here. No birds to feed on, no room for a mating swarm to form, and no colder weather to trigger hibernation. Obviously, if you want to survive, your behavior and physiology must change. To solve these problems, the formerly above-ground mosquitoes evolved into a new species, Culex pipiens molestus. The aptly named underground molestus feeds on humans and rats, mates one-to-one instead of in swarms, and doesn't hibernate, among other underground-friendly adaptations. Unlike their above-ground counterparts, their behavior and physiology suits their subterranean existence. Moreover, and were the now human you so inclined, you could meet and be bitten by mosquitoes on one line who are genetically different from those on another. Human habitat change animals in other ways, too. You'd think that starvation would pose a constant threat to wild animals living in cities. However, researchers have discovered that we humans are such a wasteful species that the wild animals in our cities grow bigger than their cohorts living in the wild. Even more interesting, given the negative impact of a lot of that human food has on us, these animals also are healthier than those in the wild. They've adapted to our junk food faster than we have. At the same time, urban wild animals have smaller territories. Foxes living in urban centers claim territories a fraction of the size they claim in the great outdoors. Like their city-dwelling human counterparts, they can find what they need to survive in less space. Wild animals who succeed in urban areas also develop traffic sense. Although vehicle-coyote collisions are common in the Chicago metro area, coyotes have learned to wait for red lights to stop traffic before they cross busy streets. They also grasp the concept of divided highways and only look in the direction of the oncoming traffic. Plants also change their behavior to adapt to city life. Whereas I just ripped weeds out of my gravel walks, not researcher Pierre-Olivier Chapteau. He studied the weeds that grow in those little patches of soil that surround trees planted in city streets. He discovered that hawksbeard plants, or hawkweed as I call it, have two seed types, little ones that float on the breeze and larger ones that fall to the ground below them. Because the greater distance between blots of soil and the city foils the floating seeds, their populations are declining compared to those of the heavier seeds that fall to the ground below the plant. But change isn't strictly a unilateral wildlife phenomena. Increasingly, more well-trained and educated professionals must possess the knowledge and skill to deal with the growing number of sick or injured wildlife that pose a danger to others. Compared to some feisty free-roaming dogs, injured bears, wild boars, snakes, and reptiles, including non-native ones from who knows where, may pose more different and more complex challenges. Although public safety sometimes demands a more weaponized approach, other times environmental awareness also changes city policy to benefit the wildlife. An increasing number of cities on migratory bird routes mandate special lighting or lights-off policies to prevent nighttime bird-building collisions or confusing light patterns. While older buildings are retrofitted to either foil or assist wildlife depending on the dangers posed, new construction rules increasingly mandate that these issues be addressed as part of the design process. All around us, wild animals and plants, many much smaller than us, are evolving to keep up with the changes generated in the artificial landscapes we create. Though fewer of them may survive in the short run, the few that do may engage in accelerated rates of evolution to support their survival in the new environment. We see it in petri dishes, in mice and rats migrating to deteriorating urban property when gentrification destroys their neighborhoods, road-savvy coyotes, urban blackbirds using slow-moving vehicles as nutcrackers, one species that evolves toward two or more thanks to an interstate or subway system. We see it in the burgeoning populations of invasive plants, parasites, and antibiotic and drug-resistant microorganisms in a world increasingly altered by humans. Ironically, in the midst of this, we humans paradoxically remain the most invasive species and yet the slowest to mature and change. We worry about other humans destroying our cities, but given our slow rate of evolution compared to that of the micro and macro plant and animal life adapting to our cities, we might be missing the bigger picture.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.